So the district stability model has been proposed for CVs in the 1980s. And of course, if you take a neutron star instead of a white dwarf, and the orbital period of low mass X-ray binary with a neutron star can be of order, I don't know, a few hours, 6 hours, 7 hours. It's not, in principle, going to be much different from a dwarf novae. It should have a more or less the same conditions in the outer disk. And so, of course, it was very natural for people to say that this model would also apply to X-ray binaries and might explain the outburst that you see. So the typical rise times, if you remember what Paul and Paula and Christian said, I think that was last week, the typical rise times are going to be 1 to 10 days for low mass X-ray binaries, but the durations are much longer. And the amplitudes are stronger as well, and they reach luminosities that can be Eddington. And so if you take a typical disk instability model and place it, change the white dwarf to a neutron star, it's not going to work at all. So this was a puzzle to people, and actually it triggered discussions that are probably relevant to this program, because people started tweaking with the angular momentum transport. So they say that, for instance, in order to explain the type of outburst that you see in X-ray transients, you would get alpha, which is, say, proportional to h over r to the power 3 halves. And they are very smart theorists, so they had very good reasons for that. at least to me, it was a little bit annoying that you would have to invoke some different type of viscosity, because we're still talking about viscosity here, in X-ray binaries compared to CVs, when the conditions are not supposed to be so dissimilar. So one thing that changes in X-ray binaries is that irradiation becomes really important in the outer disk. So naively, if you take whatever X-rays are coming from the inner regions of the disk, then you'll have something which is proportional to the inner accretion rate. And then you scale it to the viscous flux that you get at some particular radius, you do the ratio of the two, and in dimensionless units, you get something which is proportional to this constant C, which sort of parameterizes how much of the irradiation luminosity you're actually using up to heat up the disk, and then times R as a scaled as a function of the inner radius. So this constant C, I'll come back to it several times, is of the order of 10 to the minus 4 in this case. So if your outer disk radius is 10 to the 4 or bigger, times bigger than the inner radius, then irradiation heating might become important. And so what it will do, if you convert this to sigma T4, then your flux of irradiation will modify the surface temperature. So this is whatever effective temperature is given to you by the disk. This is the irradiation temperature, and of course the surface temperature will increase. This will increase the optical luminosity of your disk, because the outer regions are what are giving it optical. And so this was actually used by Jan van Paradijs and Jeff McClintock in 1994 to explain the relatively large optical to X-ray luminosity of X-ray binaries compared to dwarf novae.
So something of a similar issue arises with protostellar tests, which are thought to be largely passively heated. That is to say, that most of the radius, the dominant, the temperature is determined mainly by radiation from the center rather than from local dissipation.
But those disks are opticalistic. So it's not because the irradiation temperature is dominating, say, the surface temperature, that you're actually heating all the way through and making an isothermal disk.
There's that. That's important. What I actually was going to say is that people think it's very important the degree to which the disk flares. Mm-hmm. You have an exactly flat disk, and the source of luminosity is coming from very close to the mid plane at small radius. So actually, the radiations also are the minus 3, so the ratio.
Hang on, I will come back to this. So I'm not explaining how the disk is irradiated here. I'm just saying if you take the naive view that you have some irradiation temperature and so on. And I'm not going to specify right now what it is, but I will come back to it. So the point is, the disk is opticalistic. So of course you can irradiate the surface temperature, the surface. And the idea here is that you have soft X-rays that are giving up their energy above the disk, so you're not penetrating very deep into the disk. And so you're heating the upper layers, but you're not necessarily heating deeper layers, the midplane. In order to do this, you have to overcome the opacity. So here I'm just showing S-curves, like Jean-Marie did. So this is as a function of the surface temperature. And I actually like this plot. This is sigma as a function of the central temperature. This is the mass accretion rate. And this is the effective, the viscous effective temperature. But let's focus just on this S-curve. So here I have a typical S-curve with no irradiation. And then I'm basically increasing the irradiation that this annulus is seeing. And so typically, as I increase the temperature, at some point here, my surface temperature is actually completely determined by the irradiation temperature. So say this part of the curve here, I'm becoming dominated by the irradiation temperature. And if I look at the central temperature here, for the extreme cases, I'm actually becoming close to isothermal here. But the thing here to take out is that as I increase the surface temperature, the irradiation temperature, sorry, the lower branch of this instability may disappear, simply because if I irradiate my annulus a lot, then I may be able to actually keep it in the hot state. So the thing is that this irradiation temperature may actually end up stabilizing the disk in regions where the standard disk instability model would predict it is unstable. And it has the strongest effect on the lower branch. If you look at those curves, where I also increase the irradiation temperature, on the hot branch, it doesn't change anything, actually. So now the question is, if you want to put this into a model, then you actually need to specify how you are going to irradiate the disk. And the standard was, so you have some X-ray luminosity at the center, you have a dilution factor, you have an albedo here, and then this is going to depend on the angle between the way you're hitting the disk and the normal to the disk. And if you assume that the disk height is small, then you can convert this into an H over R formula, which is the one that people have been using. The problem is that regardless of, if you want to do this stuff consistently, then you construct a disk model, an alpha disk model, same disk. You compute H, and you can take, for instance, the photosphere height, or you can take the pressure scale height. And then you try to self-consistently irradiate the disk with this. And you find out that it just doesn't work. You are never able to irradiate the outer regions of the disk. And the reason is that the flaring, you do flare in the beginning, because in a Shakura-San LF disk, this will be proportional to R. H over R is proportional to R to R over 8. But in this hot region, the irradiation doesn't make much of a difference. So you actually never get into this region where you would be completely dominated by irradiation. And by the time you would actually go to the you would like to irradiate those outer parts. Those outer parts are actually cold if they are unstable. And if they are cold, so look at this H over R, this is the photosphere. So the height is increasing more or less like a Shakura-Sanyaev disk. But then you're cold in the outer regions, so of course the height completely drops. And you're basically shadowing the cold region from the central source. So if you do this with this formula, this is not going to work. So you need to assume something else. And that this something else, actually, we don't really know. We know that disks are irradiated, but we don't really know how. So either you need a scattering corona, which will allow some of the central flux to be scattered off above the plane and come back on the outer regions. Or you actually need to warp your disk. And we know that there is a, if you irradiate the disk with a central point source, then there is a torque that is exerted on the outer disk that can actually warp it and so expose some of the outer regions to the central flux. Except that this instability or this warp actually only occurs for very big disks. So at least to me, it's not clear that this is the mechanism that is at work in most of the systems. Or you can assume a lamppost model as in AGM models. We don't know the answer to this, so we parameterize our ignorance by yet another parameter that was introduced actually by Shakura-Sanyaev. Everything is in Shakura-Sanyaev. So this parameter C is already found there. And the value of this parameter C is about 5 × 10⁻³. There are several ways to estimate it. So say from the comparison to the optical fluxes. But there's also a way to estimate it from the disk instability.
Does it vary from system to system by a lot?
By a lot, probably not. It may vary, say, during an outburst, say, if you had a warp, temporary warp, you could increase this value. See, it depends also on the albedo of the disk. Depends probably on the type of X-ray radiation that you get. But I wouldn't say it varies a lot about around this value.
Because, I mean, some of the disks are much, much bigger than, in some cases, than others, right? So mm-hmm. Saying it depends on temperatures or other things, I mean, it sounds like it doesn't, or at least...
I'll show you, I'll give you the reason why I think it probably doesn't vary a lot. Yeah. So the reason is there. So Jean-Marie explained the S-curves actually can be translated into an instability criterion. So if you have a disk of a given size and a given mass accretion rate, then this criterion tells you whether it is stable or unstable. And this is a very strong prediction of the disk instability model. And to me, actually, this is the main reason why we believe this model has at least some element of truth. And so this instability criterion will be modified by irradiation, as I just showed. If you irradiate the outer regions a lot, then they will become stable. So the criterion will be changed, and this can be taken into account. And this was actually done by Jan van Paradijs in 1996. And in 2012, with Michael Correa and Rob Fender, we decided to revisit this. And at the time, I thought that the outcome would be that with all the X-ray transients that we have seen, this criterion was likely going to fail at some point, and it would be interesting to see how it fails. But actually, it turned out that it works extremely well, and Michael did a beautiful job of trying to estimate. The important thing here is to estimate the mass transfer rate. The size of the disk, you can more or less get from the orbital period. That's not too difficult. But estimating the mass transfer rate can be tricky, and he did a very good job of this. And so what this plot shows you is the criterion. So orbital period will be more or less the size of the disk. And the mass transfer rate is here. And so the open symbols are stable systems, and the filled symbols are unstable systems. And with the non-irradiated disk, all this part should be stable, and all this part should be unstable. So you see that wouldn't work, because you have lots of stable systems in there. But if you include the irradiation with a factor C, which is about 5 × 10⁻, then you get this, and you have a pretty good separation between stable and unstable systems. So that's why I think, you know, this factor C shouldn't vary too much from system to system. And the same works for black holes. And for some reason that I'd be interested in knowing, it seems that most black holes are transients, if not all. So, and this has always been a puzzle to me. But anyway, so this works also quite well. So I think this is really one of the strongest points of the disk instability model, and a good reason to seek it actually is something, there is something there.
A comment on the two points at the very right.
Those two here?
Yeah.
So which ones are, I don't have much time. I refer to you to the discussion in this paper.
Which explains.
And,
There's no reason to think there's any.
It's not necessarily a problem.
Because there's such long periods, basically.
Well, you don't know so much about it. 17, 40, you don't always know the distances. It's anyway. Let me skip over this if I may. I'm going to skip over this as well. So the thing is, I haven't talked about light curves. Now, what happens if you let the light curve, the instability develop? Because if you still have a big enough system, then the instability will develop. Then the effect of the irradiation will be to keep the disk hot longer. And by keeping the disk hot longer, you actually get longer recurrence times, longer outburst. And you also get more easily exponential decays, which is something that I've been seeing in the observations. And this is not very complicated to explain, but let me go to the next points. The thing is, the disk is thin, so by construction, it will not be able to explain the hard X-rays that we see in X-ray transients. So in X-ray transients, you have soft components, soft spectral components, but you also have hard states, where most of the X-rays are emitted around, way above 10 keV, and way above 10 keV, 100 keV is definitely not something that the standard disk instability model with a thin disk will be able to explain. So you need an additional ingredient. And spectral modeling of those hard states indicates that you may have something which is optically thin, probably collisionless. And what you're seeing is a combination of quantum, synchrotron, branch panel, but clearly that you have some type of accretion flow that is changing as you get closer to the neutron star black hole. And this is really where the difference between white dwarfs and neutron star black holes comes in, because you're going deeper into the potential well, and for some reason or another, this is changing things. So there is some evidence from the spectral, from the spectra, that you have some form of truncation, what we have called truncation, or evaporation of the thin disk into something else, some other type of accretion flow. What I would like to stress here is that there is also evidence for some truncation like this, just based on the disk instability model. That is, if you don't include some transition to a hot accretion flow inside, or at least some other type of accretion flow, then it's not possible to explain actually the shape of the orbits that we get. So the first reason was actually presented by Jean-Pierre in 96. So the thing is, this is showing the density profiles in an accretion disk as you go back from outburst into quiescence. And so, as Jean-Marie mentioned, you're going to go to something which is close to sigma min, which is actually also close to sigma max, meaning it behaves more or less the same way. But the thing is, if your whole disk goes into quiescence, then that means that at the inner edge, your surface density has to be very small, smaller than the maximum sigma for which you would trigger an outburst. So if you want your whole disk to go into quiescence, then you really have to go to very, very low mass transfer mass accretion rates. In fact, that would mean that if you go to the Schwarzschild radius, then the mass accretion rate in quiescence should be of order 10 kilograms per second. But you see, of course, X-ray luminosities of the order of 10 to the 31, 10 to the 32 works per second. So this is incompatible. So in order to avoid this, truncate the disk will give you a higher mass transfer, mass accretion rate onto the hot accretion flow and then onto the compact object. The second thing is, because you have very low surface densities, then it's very easy to trigger an outburst. So typically, if you don't evaporate your disk, then any little bit of matter that's falling into small radii will be enough to trigger a new outburst. And so this is a plot from John Canizzo, where basically you are showing, he is showing the outburst light curves. And then as you go from one panel to the other, he's basically increasing the truncation radius of the disk. So you see that when you have not much truncation, a disk that is going very much inside, close to the compact object, you have mainly small outbursts. But as you increase the truncation, you get much longer recurrence times. The second reason. The third reason is a little bit technical, but not an, is that you get reflex, and I'm not sure I want to get into reflex. I think this is a bit too much, probably. But that's a worry. So, if you truncate and irradiate the disk, then basically you get something that looks at least a little bit, in terms of timescales and amplitudes, like neutron star and black hole transits, with the same values of the alpha parameter that are in dwarf novae, which I think, at least to me, is comfort, is a comfort. Yeah. If we can find some explanation of why alpha changes in the cold branch and in the hot branch, in dwarf novae, then I think the same thing should apply to the outer disks of black hole and neutron star transients. The downside is we need to have some prescription for our operation, understand why at some point the accretion flow decides to change state. Of course, there is a wider variety of light curves, so that points to additional physics, but I'm not going to go into this. Let me go directly. I'll skip the movie. I had enough movies. So let me go to, directly to the conclusions. So this guy irradiated. That we know for sure from the observations, but we don't really know how. The stability works pretty well. Actually, it works better than what I would have ever expected. The irradiation will change the light curves, but you also need the disk to be truncated. We get the same values of alpha, and what sets of values is completely relevant to this program. And I think another point which is relevant to this program is what drives this truncation. So basically, this is related to state changes. We haven't had really a discussion about state changes and how this might relate to the magneto hydrodynamics of the flow, or there have been several papers in the past years discussing this. But the thing is, you have both evidence from the spectral side and from the dynamics that you need to have something that triggers right. those changes.
We had an observational talk in the very first week on state transitions, but yeah, we should have a discussion, I agree. Just so that clear, the evidence for the disk being truncated, what you need is when you transition back into quiescence, you need to have already evaporated the inner disk in order to, so that the cooling front doesn't have to propagate all the way into the inner disk and drive you into quiescence. You don't want that.
No, I want the disk to come into full quiescence before it actually reaches the compact object, way before. So right. say on the scale right. of 1,000 times the gravitational radius, which is actually maybe a problem because observations, I didn't mention this, but observations show that disks are truncated. You will, for instance, in XT1118, where you had excellent extreme UV coverage, you could actually feed the UV spectra with a thin disk model and find that the inner disk radius was maybe 100 times Schwarzschild radius of the black hole. So the thin disk was definitely not extending all the way.
That's fine. I just was.
Any further questions? There are refreshments available.
Just one comment. Because one can read in the literature a very misleading information, which is a disinformation, that based on this work, one knows the value of alpha in X-ray binaries. In general, I think that we know the alpha in the X-ray emitting part of the disk, which is not true. This disk gives only the alpha in the optically emitting disk. It tells nothing about the inner. So alpha could be anything from this point of view.
For the first time, mental arithmetic in on the new. The truncation radius in X-ray binaries in actual physical units is very comparable to what's needed in CD8, right? Around 10, a few times 9, a few times 10. Mm-hmm. Is that coincidence? I mean, if we invoke magnetic truncation, for example, as the default in CDs.
How are you going to get this in the black hole transfer?
Well, exactly.
Just a very good question.
I mean, they.
There's
which means that I don't know the answer. So there's a lot, there's a lot of discussion about what causes the truncation to like these SN and Narayan models where you have a hot ADAP and a disk. And it's simply the fact, the viscous time and the cooling time. So if you assume it's the hot ADAP, you can calculate an optically thin cooling time and a viscous time. And if you equate the two, it's essentially goes all the way back to reset all 1982 that, when m dot is less than alpha square, m dot.
So this is basically the prescription for evaporation. So you have a critical right. mass accretion rate for an ADAP flow. And so this tells you that at some point you reach this critical mass accretion rate, and then you assume that at this point you're starting to have an ADAP, so we truncate the disk. Are we sure we know this?
Right. So we don't know, for example, the plot of truncation radius as a function of m dot, or m dot Eddington. But there are some ideas, like conduction, conductive evaporation,
yes.
So on can help it. But there is some baseline model.
So I remember looking at this once, and was actually this is years ago though. I was really disappointed by there seemed to be as many prescriptions for how the evaporation radius scales with. Anything.
Yeah, I can tell you which one we're using.
I'd just like to introduce what some may regard as a distraction and some regard as a real issue, which is the spectral shape in these X-ray binaries changes rather little over a wide range of luminosity. And in particular, you know, the systems like SIGACS, in which the volumetric luminosity changes by what, 50% from hard state to soft state?
Not much.
Yeah. In fact, there was a paper on the archive just about a week ago looking at more detailed X-ray reprocessing spectra for, I forget, GX something or other, in a relatively bright hard state, and arguing that, in fact, the disk had to extend basically all the way in.
And there's other observational evidence that that might be happening too, although this is debated viciously, I would say, among various groups in the X-ray astronomers. Maybe on that note, let's leave it for today. And thank you.